Welcome to Holden Village and the Holden Theological Conference, sponsored by the Lutheran Education Network and Support. Today is Wednesday, September the 27th, 1995. In the Village Center this morning, we're going to be listening in on Ethical Dilemmas in National Healthcare Reform. Our speaker, Chaplain Metcalf. Let's listen in.
I've never been to Holden Village before, so it is a unique and wonderful opportunity for me. I love the mountains. I love the ocean, the heavier in the Northwest. Being raised in Illinois, it's a pretty great place to be. It's very interesting to hear Dr. Lull talk to us about the dilemmas that are faced in the world of theology, those of you that are struggling in the parish ministry, and also to hear him talk about the future of theological education and the debates that are going on in that field. And then yesterday, to hear Dr. Hartung talk to us about the pressures that are on clergy and on the churches that we serve. Again, I thought that was an outstanding presentation. And then this morning, Dr. Stoltz talked to us about how to increase and enhance our own personal devotions. Obviously, on the agenda for the 3 days that we're here, I wind up being sort of tail end Charlie as far as the presentations go, which is fine, because this is my first time here. I think I should be last. There's something in the Bible about the first shall be last, and I guess that's what makes me one of the last speakers for it. My role today is to bring all of you up to date on some very vital concerns that we have about national healthcare reform. And I bring you these concerns, as you see in the outline that have been distributed, not only from myself as one who is a preceptor of a 5-day ethics program offered at our hospital. By the way, we're really proud of that program. We started it up 3 years ago, and we started out of my chaplain's office to train VA hospital chaplains in clinical ethics, so they could serve on an ethics committee in their hospital and train them how to do the ethical decision-making model to help doctors and nurses decide ethical dilemmas at the bedside of the patients they're caring for. Well, it went way beyond our wildest expectations, and we now have more doctors and nurses and psychologists, we even have hospital administrators and lawyers taking the course, and we're now having more clinicians than we are chaplains taking the course. We take 12 people about 3 times a year, although last year we ran the course 5 times because of demand. And the reason I mention this to you is that I kind of, known as the preceptor, which means I orchestrate, I do a lot of the teaching, but I orchestrate a faculty of 10 to 12 people from 4 institutions, the 2 VA hospitals, ours in Portland and up here in Seattle. And then both universities have affiliated ethics centers, Oregon Health Sciences University, which is right across the ridge from the VA hospital in Portland. And then the University of Washington in Seattle has a terrific ethics center with Dr. Al Johnson there. Some of you may have heard of him. He's one of the premier ethicists in the nation and is serving as one of the ethicists on the Federal Genome Research Project. So this faculty, 10 or 12 people, comprise the teaching folks and the faculty for ethics residency. When I have vacant seats out of the 10 or 12 slots that we teach 3 to 5 times a year, I always slide in Lutheran clergy. So those of you that live in the Portland area, wish to commute down, I always try to sneak in a few Missouri Synod or ELCA clergy that can set in on it, and be glad to talk to you about that at a later date. That's just a very crass commercial for our ethics residency program. I'd like to begin by telling you a true story. True story from my grandfather's autobiography. My grandfather graduated from Missouri Synod's Springfield Concordia Seminary, Springfield, Illinois, almost a century ago in 1897. And on my study at home, I've got a very valued picture of his class, another picture of the faculty of 7 people that were there then, and a collage of snapshots or photographs they took of the building. Now, my grandfather, when he graduated in 1897, besides his diploma, was given 2 additional pieces of paper. One was a railroad ticket on the Missouri-Kansas-Texas Railroad to El Paso, a one-way ticket. And they said, well, you got to go out there and start mission work in El Paso, Texas. The other piece of paper they gave him was the name of a German family that the seminary thought might be living in El Paso. And he said, go start a church. Well, Grandpa did. He was my maternal grandfather, Reverend Herbert Hubotter, tall, stately gentleman with a mustache. I never saw him anything but a white shirt and a black bow tie his entire life. He went out there and he started a church. And here's the story. In his little autobiography that he left me, God bless him, he lived to be 93 and actually ordained me in 1960. He left me an autobiography, and in that he tells a story. Those in Missouri Synod recognize the name of Dr. Francis Pieper, three volumes of Christian dogmatics we had to study, memorize. ELC may have heard about it. He was professor at the seminary in St. Louis at the time my grandfather graduated. And after Grandpa and Grandma had this little Lutheran church started in El Paso, in the middle of the night one night, somebody knocked on the front door. He went to the front door, opened it up, and this young man was standing there, and in German spoke to my grandfather and said, are you the local Lutheran pastor? And Grandfather says, yes. He says, well, I am the son of Dr. Francis Pieper, and I have run off to Mexico because Daddy wants me to be a pastor, and I don't want to be a pastor. I ran away from home. He said, but I'm on my way back to St. Louis because this next weekend is my mother's birthday, and I want to go home for her birthday. Grandma and Grandpa put him up in the parsonage, and at the crack of dawn, he was riding the railroad trains, bumming a ride on the cattle trains. So early the next morning, the crack of dawn, Grandma fixed him a lunch, and he got up crack of dawn to catch this cattle train and to bum a ride back to St. Louis. A week went by, and sure enough, again in the middle of the night, somebody knocked on the door. Grandpa opened, and here stands this young man who in German said, the damn train went to Wyoming. True story. And I use that as an illustration to bring us to the point of one of my concerns that I think the train of healthcare reform in our country may be headed down the wrong track. He thought he was going to go to St. Louis and he wound up somewhere else. Our nation is trying to reform healthcare, but I am worried about some of the ethical dilemmas that we see in the world of medicine. The paper I present to you is unpublished. I'm not the sole author. It is a combined paper of myself and one of my former bosses, who is now the director of a hospital up in New York. Mr. Stuart Collier is a very faithful family man, happens to be of the religion of Latter-day Saints, but a very strong family man, very dedicated to his religion. And he and I were having coffee one day, and we were talking about our concerns. And we decided to write a paper. And I'd like to share that information with you today. I'm going to walk you through relatively fast the content thereof and then throw it wide open for your discussions. I would appreciate legitimate questions and comments and a critique, because we still have a pipe dream of publishing this thing someday. And I've got his permission to bring it to Holden Village and share with a bunch of Lutherans. So here we go. Ethical dilemmas from the inside of healthcare facilities as to what we are worried about, some trends in healthcare reform. I believe these are important things for you to know because it'll affect not only you and your family's insurance in healthcare in the future, but the healthcare of all of your parishioners. This is a hot debate in the media today and the political agenda of our country. We believe that there are five dangerous trends that may take us down the wrong railroad track in healthcare reform. And our concern is that in the stampede for an ethical distribution of healthcare, that three of the four classical principles that have guided medical care and medical ethics since the days of Hippocrates, 400 years before Christ, that some of those ethical principles may indeed be trampled upon and indeed may even be killed in the rush for the debate over which of the six theories of allocation of healthcare resources that are being debated in our country. I'm not going to bore you with the six different theories, but I will tell you that the four historical principles that have guided medicine and Western civilization since the days of Hippocrates through the Old Testament Torah, the moral laws that we learned, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt honor thy father and thy mother, through the book of Leviticus that gives us all of the civil laws of the Hebrew friends of ours, and then catapults us into the New Testament era where Jesus gave us parables with principles, such as the parable of the Good Samaritan, which leads my army hospital medical units to dedication to treat even the enemy's wounded, providing we have enough leftover medicine. The parable of the Good Samaritan had an outstanding effect on Western civilization's ethical standards in medical care. Now, those four principles are beneficence, which means do good. A doctor's first responsibility to a patient is to save life or prolong it, or at least remove the pain and the symptoms. The second great historical principle of medical ethics is non-maleficence, which means if you can't do any good, at least you don't do any harm to your patient. And I suggest to you that Dr. Kevorkian has trampled that one all over the place. When a doctor sees harm being done to his or her patient, he must not only stop it if he's doing it himself, but he must prevent others from doing harm to his patients. That one was neglected in the healthcare profession of Nazi Germany. Later, and I will quote to you a book written by two psychiatrists who went back and reviewed the Nazi medical trials that were not well known because of the political trials or on the media after World War II. The third principle is the principle of autonomy of the patient. And this one, again, really came on very strong and was probably one of the dominant ethical principles immediately after World War II, and especially with the yuppie generation of me first, last, and always. And it is the patient's autonomy, probably, that is the supreme principle as far as power goes in today's medicine. And the last one, the fourth one, is justice, what is good for the greater society in which we live. Now, that one has six theories of how to distribute health care. And again, I'm not going to belabor the 6 points. I won't even list them. But ladies and gentlemen, those are the four classical guidance principles that have guided medical ethics for thousands of years. And I'm here to tell you that our concern from inside the world of medicine and hospitals where many of us work, we are concerned that out of the four, in our stampede to decide which political group and which lobbying group will be successful in having their theory of economic distribution of health care promoted and passed by Congress and the Senate of the United States, that in so doing and in fighting over which one of those theories will win, that we may perhaps kill or at least do deadly damage to the other three principles. And we are here today, Mr. Collier and myself, are here to present to you a paper that says we need to keep the balance of power between all four ethical principles. And here's the five trends we see that endanger all of those principles. The first of which is the impact of politics, lobbyists, and economics on hospital managers. Now, this part was written by my colleague, Mr. Collier. But I share with you his information. For those of you who would like to know, healthcare industry today is a $400 billion industry. That's with a B. Now, that's a little beyond my local budget and the budget of my hospital. So I had this figured out by Mr. Collier one day, and he said that this averages out not only to 30 or 40% of the gross national product of our country, but he broke it down in terms that I could understand. Our nation spends $12,000 per second, day and night, on health care. Now, that I can comprehend. That's a lot of money. $12,000 every second of every year our nation spends on health care. And 1% of all of that money is spent, 1% of the gross national product of our nation is spent on elderly patients during the last year of his or her life. 1% of our gross national product is spent on the elderly patients during the last year of their life. Now, there are political pressures today on healthcare reform. There are state reform policies being developed, such as the Oregon Health Decisions Plan. There is an organization out of Chicago that evaluates all hospitals and nursing homes once every year, or perhaps every other year, the Joint Commission on Hospital Accreditation Organization, and they demand that you must document everything. And this is a tremendous economic burden on our hospitals. This year, for the first time, the Joint Commission is under great attack by hospitals and HMOs because of the amount of staff time developed to prepare for the onslaught of their investigation. We just went through it in my hospital 3 weeks ago. And now all of the institutions are doing a cost study on what it takes to prepare for this visit. The legacy system, those of you from Portland know the legacy hospital system, they told us that they estimate that they spent over $200,000 preparing for the evaluation of the Joint Commission. My hospital, the Portland VA Medical Center, which comprises not only the big medical center in Portland, but our long-term care facilities in Vancouver, we estimate that we will spend over $1 million getting ready for this one-year review that lasts 4 days. Now, the political pressures that managers under come from insurance companies in the civilian sector, where you have corporate hospitals that are motivated by profit motive and the bottom line economics. And then when it comes to the lobbyists, the lobbyists in healthcare are phenomenal. There is an interagency federal healthcare institute in Washington, D.C., who track lobbyists. Take a guess at how many lobbying organization and lobbyists are registered inside the Beltway of Washington, D.C., just on healthcare alone. 745 registered lobbyists in Washington, D.C., just on healthcare issues alone. They're always banging on the congressmen and the senators for their view, one of the six arguments, their view of how healthcare distribution should be doled out in our country. And then on top of that, you have all of the laws regarding Medicare and Medicaid that are up for grabs right now with the Congress and Senate. Then hospital directors are under terrific pressure of cost containment today. All government hospitals, be they military or VA, are under budget restraints because we too are being downsized, just as are military and military hospitals. There is no doubt that the federal government is going to reduce the federal budget. In the civilian sector, where you have hospitals for corporate profit motives, and where you have HMOs, health maintenance organization institutions, like the Kaiser Permanente program, they are motivated to cut costs, and their doctors are paid bonuses if they can keep down the cost of prognosing and diagnosing and treating their patients' illnesses. As an example, the average kidney dialysis patient in our country costs $35,000 a year to maintain on dialysis. And AIDS patients, in the last year and a half of an AIDS patient's life, the medical costs are $150,000 for the last year and one half of their treatment. Health maintenance organizations in our country have enrolled 50 million patients since 1990. And today, nationwide in our country, there is a shift away from admitting you to a hospital bed for your diagnosis, prognosis, and treatment into health maintenance and preventative care. And the big shift today is from inpatients to outpatients and ambulatory care. Even in the VA, we have rented a huge building on the south side of Portland, and all of our doctors and nurses are rotating down there. And we are desperately trying to change the mentality of the chaplain corps in the VA system of 171 hospitals with 1,300 chaplains. We're trying to change a longly ingrained idea of doctors, nurses, hospital managers, and in our chaplaincy itself to shift our pastoral care responsibilities from the inpatient. Well, you're going to see the patient who's death and dying. But we've got to go down and figure out how to minister to people who are walk-ins for a temporary infection or an anxiety attack, as Dr. Hartung talked to us yesterday, that come into our psychiatric clinics. How do you shift pastoral care to that area? Well, this is a great struggle going on today nationwide, not only in the VA and VA chaplaincy, but in the civilian sector chaplaincy as well. The second impact and the second dangerous trend that we see, besides all of these economic, political dangers that can stampede our country into neglecting some equitable balance of our ethical principles of doing good and avoiding evil and patient autonomy, there's another impact that is very subtle but yet is coming floating to the surface, and that is the impact of litigation and malpractice in the world of medicine. Quote to you two sources. Paul Menzel's book, who teaches at Pacific Lutheran University, wrote an outstanding book called Strong Medicine. And he writes it from his past profession, where he knows economics quite well. And my second source to you is a summer issue of 1993 Journal of Law, Medicine, and Ethics. And here's what they tell us. Malpractice and litigation costs in the world of healthcare, and I've narrowed it down to Washington State. In Washington State, the average doctor pays $15,000 a year for malpractice insurance. That adds $5 to every visit you make to the clinic, and it adds $15 to every day that you lay in a hospital or nursing home bed to your cost, $15 a day just for the doctor's malpractice insurance. Now, what is happening is this litigation and the fear of malpractice has indeed become a policing agency for physicians. Whereas prior to this, as all of us know, a true profession must have peer review to determine what is malpractice. Today it's being decided in courts by juries, not by the medical associations, by one's peers. In the economic policing of physicians today, and here's where we're concerned about destroying peer review, it cost $52 billion, that's with a B, $1 billion per year to practice defensive medicine. $52 billion a year to practice defensive medicine. And the latest estimate is this. The average settlement for a malpractice claim in the United States is $300,000 goes to the victim of malpractice. There are two systems, computerized system, being developed today under the Federal Freedom of Information Act. One is called MedLARS, the other is MedIS, and it's a computerized tracking system of doctors to determine their rating, because insurance companies want to know what their rating is to determine what they charge them to protect them from malpractice insurance. And the government also wants to know a doctor or nurse's track record today before they hire them. And I can tell you a personal experience in my VA hospital. We had a part-time doctor worked in our hospital. Terrific guy, strong Christian. He ran a clinic in part of Portland as a charitable institution to reach the disenfranchised, the poor, and the minorities in Northeast Portland. He developed and ran a clinic free. But one of his clients there filed a malpractice suit against him. Now, the malpractice suit was thrown out. But he forgot or failed to report that to the VA Chief of Staff's office, required by VA, and across the ravine at Oregon Health and Sciences University, where he trained residents in surgery. And because he did not report that, he was fired. One of the strongest Christian doctors we had on our staff was fired because he neglected to report a malpractice suit that he won and the defendant lost. But that gives you an idea of the policing of physicians that is starting to take over. The other thing that concerns us is that when it comes to the federal court system or a state court system on health care or on malpractice litigation, often the judge's gavel becomes the hammer of policy in health care. The U.S. Supreme Court in making legal landmark cases such as the Nancy Cruzan case, the fallout from these legal landmark cases in Nancy Cruzan's, as an example only, is that in 1991, when Congress and Senate passed the omnibus budget bill for the entire federal government in 91, there was a rider tacked onto the tail end of that bill, which said, from now on, any institution, whether it's a hospital or nursing home, that gets $1 of federal care, Medicare or Medicaid, you are now required to ask every patient admitted to a bed, do you have an advance directive filled out? And if the advance directive is not there, or the patient says, what the heck is that, you send in a social worker or a nurse, or in some places a chaplain who hands out the literature. You cannot force the patient to fill one out, but you ask them for that. And that is a law that came right out of the Nancy Cruzan case, where the family begged the hospital for years to unhook not only the respirator at first, and then she lived on, but finally, ultimately, withdraw nutrition and hydration. Those are medical terms for food and water. You know, when you want to do something, you change the name, and it makes it a little more acceptable sometimes. I'm showing a little bias on my part here. But she eventually died. But because of the calamity that this thing worked its way up from the state to the federal U.S. Supreme Court, a federal law is now in effect. The third concern we have is the push for an early death in an aging society. leads me to share something with you. For a long, long time, you know, I always considered myself to be a yuppie. You know what that acronym is, a young urban professional person. I work in Portland. You know, I have my degree, and I'm doing great stuff in the chaplaincy. I thought I was a yuppie. And then I was reminded by one of my younger chaplains that I was not a yuppie. I might be a muppie. That's a middle-aged urban professional. My oldest son said, Dad, no, you're an opie. We won't even go into that. But for those of you that may be muppies or opies in the audience, let me tell you one of the concerns we see. And that is, there is a push in medicine today for an early death in what we've heard several times here in this conference, in the aging society of America. Some statistics for you. A gentleman wrote a book called, his name is Veach, Dr. Veach. He wrote a book called Cross-Cultural Perspectives in Medical Ethics. I want to read something to you from page 30 and following. Listen to the questions. He doesn't tell you what he wants, but he asks the question which implies his answer. Now remember, we're concerned here about a doctor's responsibility to save life, to preserve life, or at least do no harm to the patient, and have the patient's autonomy involved, and then last but not least, you know, look out for the rest of society. Here's what Veach says. Do we pool our limited resources and manpower in healthcare to apply cures and medicine to all those who are now deprived of it, or should we continue to multiply the complexity of services for the privileged few? Do we apply mass prophylaxis against diseases, or do we spend our resources repairing damaged heart valves with expensive heart surgery after they've been damaged? And then he makes a statement, every death prevented or life prolonged alters the number of people, the kind of people, and the distribution of human beings on our planet. Then he says, the resulting competition for living space, for food, and for conveniences has already imperiled our hope for a life of satisfaction for all mankind. End of quote. Another quote from his book. It's not good enough to hope that the good of the community will grow fortuitously out of the summation of good acts that every physician has for his or her own patients. See, he's taking a pot shot at the ethical principle of beneficence and non-maleficence when he says that. And then he goes on, he says, can we absolve ourselves from the responsibility for deficiencies in the distribution, the quality, and the accessibility of even ordinary medical care for the poor, the uneducated, and the disenfranchised? Or do we direct our health care system to care for the young in the ghettos and the underprivileged countries of the world? Or do we continue to give it away to the affluent aged? Which course will make for a better world, he asks. He says, ah, these are vexing questions of the utmost social concern. End of quote. Here's an ethicist writing a very popular, well-read book in our field of the world of ethics. And it's an argument that we need to take away high-tech, high-cost, expensive treatment from the opies and give it away to the yuppies or children. I don't know what's right here, ladies and gentlemen, but I'm saying this is a trend I can tell you is out there, and it is pushing in on the ethical decisions that doctors are making about the care of Americans in our country. It is also becoming a driving force in the Senate and Congress as they debate these issues. Another concern, let me hearken back to the advanced directive law. The advanced directive law at this point is not required that you must fill one out, but you will be required, the hospital or the nursing home will be required to give you adequate information so that you can fill out an advanced directive, a living will. It's kind of a misnomer for a death will, actually. Or durable power of attorney for health care. Note that all three of these documents, any one of which you can sign, fill out, and, you know, tape to the, by the way, the emergency people always look on your refrigerator door for your advanced directive. It's where you're supposed to put it and give one to your doctor and one to the hospital when you walk in or carried in. Have you ever thought that the advanced directive is a law with a door that only swings one way? To an early death? And when we implemented this directive in our hospital, there was a huge shootout at OK Corral about who's going to do this for the patient. Nursing said, we're too busy. Let the admitting clerk down in the front door of the hospital ask the patients that. The people running admitting clerk said, no, we can't do that because the GS-3 level clerk will say, if you got advanced directive, and one of our old veterans say, what the heck is that? And the clerk will say, well, it's still when the doctor pulled the plug on you. But basically, that's what it's all about. It is a door that opens only one way. Along with that, I remind you of the current law that is being debated, and it is on hold now with an injunction. And Judge Hagan down in Salem has now declared, federal circuit judge, has now declared that the law authorizing assisted suicide is unconstitutional. And believe me, that one will go to the U.S. Supreme Court. And however that turns out, will be a gavel with a heavy hammer blow on medical ethics, whichever way it turns out. I can tell you this, that the ELCA and Missouri Synod both were online to oppose the passage of this bill in Oregon. I represented Missouri Synod at a coalition of churches and other healthcare organizations that tried to fight it. We were unsuccessful. The Oregon bill, the physician-assisted suicide, is called the Death with Dignity Act in Oregon. A footnote to that story, you may want to know something that is not well advertised in the media, and that is it's been going on in practice in the world in Netherlands for a long time. 3 years ago, when I had Derek Humphrey at my hospital being debated by a doctor from Seattle, we filled the auditorium on that debate with pastoral care grand rounds that day on ethics. And It was 3 years ago, and Mr. Humphrey, who was promoting Dr. Seuss's suicide, was very much in favor of this, and he was grandly pointing everybody how well it worked in the Netherlands. 3 years later, when it was being debated in Oregon, they didn't want to talk anymore about what happened in the Netherlands, because this is what happened. In the Remmelijk study, Remmelijk is the gentleman who is sort of like the Surgeon General of the Netherlands, and he puts out a report every year, and last year's report, it's now known that in the Netherlands, last year, 1,040 patients were euthanized by doctors without telling the patient what they were going to do to them because, two reasons given. One is, as a physician, I feel my patient has suffered enough. And the second one was, as a physician, I know that the family can't stand the suffering of their loved one any longer. So they have euthanized 1,040 people without telling the patient what they were about to do to end their life. So the Hemlock Society doesn't talk about the Netherlands experiment anymore. Now let me move on to the fourth one that concerns me. Medicine by mathematics. This may be a new one to you. It is a fourth and probably the most recent trend in medical research. Apache 3 has nothing whatsoever to do with our Native American friends. It is the third version of a research proposal. It's an acronym. You don't have to worry about this, but the acronym stands for Acute Physiology, Age, and Chronic Health Evaluation. It is a computerized prophet. What it prophesies, if this thing ever becomes a healthcare tool, if you were rushed up to the hospital by a family member or an ambulance, and you're rushed in the emergency ward, they will someday take your healthcare card, by the way, and it'll all be computerized, and it'll have your entire medical history plus your genome genetic coding system implanted in a credit card-sized thing. The doctor, the nurse will pop it in a computer, and it'll do a quick mathematical prophecy as to whether or not you should even be admitted for treatment, or whether they say, I'm sorry, but because of your age, your past medical history, in your genetic tendencies, we will not treat you. Go home and die. Oh, now this is only a research experiment at this time. It's in its third version, but I suggest to you that perhaps the fourth or fifth version of this could possibly be a mathematical prophet that would determine who gets treated in the intensive care units and who will be refused treatment. Because I can assure you that the profit-oriented hospitals or HMOs, if they have access to this information, will develop ways in which healthcare will be limited by mathematics. And will the principle of economic justice override the historic principles of beneficence and non-maleficence and what your autonomy is in case you do want to live in spite of the odds? Because it'll be an odds. It will be a computerized crapshoot based on the roll of the dice as whether you should or should not be treated. All of our doctors say, hey, I have patients out there walking around that I thought should be dead years ago. It's a concern that we have. The fifth concern that I would bring before you is something you may not be aware of, and this is what we are concerned about in healthcare called punitive medicine. These are storm clouds on the horizon, but I can tell you they are coming at you. There is a Dr. Swartz who published an article in 1992 in a journal called the Cambridge Quarterly of Healthcare Ethics. And in his article, he says, enough already. We need to start punishing people for bad lifestyles by removing their health care. Now, if this becomes policy, it could force physicians and healthcare maintenance organizations and in corporate hospitals are motivated by profit, not charity, to plan and execute your healthcare plan based on your lifestyle and whether or not you followed your prior doctor's directions on losing weight, quit smoking, et cetera, et cetera. He is suggesting that patients should lose their health care privileges and be punished if they refuse to follow the doctor's advice. This one really kills beneficence, non-maleficence, and your autonomy. It kills three of the historic principles. Now, you think that'll never happen. Let me give you a case where it did happen. I serve on the liver transplant selection committee of my hospital. We do not only VA veterans, but we do civilians that come to us through the doors of Oregon Health Science University. The same night, on a Wednesday night, we had two candidates, both of whom had killed their livers by drinking too much alcohol. Both had cirrhosis of the liver induced from alcoholism. One was a veteran, one was a civilian, non-veteran. One, the veteran, is being paid for by the federal budget. We're allotted to do 20 a year. The other is being paid for under the Oregon Health Plan. Social worker came in and said, I'm sorry, but Oregon Health Plan will not play for the civilian's liver transplant because he falls below the line because he's an alcoholic. If he had hepatitis, we'd transplant him. But he's an alcoholic. They still treat alcoholism as a sin instead of a disease. We said yes to one, no to the other. Punitive medicine is occurring now in our country. Dr. Menzel, I quote to you again from his book, Strong Medicine. He says, and I quote, that the intent of this book is to encourage the elderly of our nation to no longer consume large quantities of healthcare resources for their chronic illnesses, because that obviously occur during the latter stages of their life. In an aging America, Dr. Menzel believes that the elderly, and this is a quote, have a duty to die efficiently and early to conserve healthcare resources for the young, the disenfranchised, and the poor. Now, I don't know who's right and who's wrong here. I'm telling you that there is the specter of human needs, and I'm concerned about what I see as the storm clouds of punitive medicine coming at us. So that you won't think I'm alone on this, let me quote to you from another great book just published in 1993. It's a book called Psychiatric Ethics by two psychiatrists, Dr. Block and Dr. Kotoff. They went back to Germany. They reviewed the atrocities done by the Nazi medical world, not the Nazi party. And they wrote this book. These two psychiatrists authored the book, Psychiatric Ethics, and they discovered on reviewing the historical documents out of Germany that the gas chambers and the death camps of Germany were originally created in the late 1930s under the medical profession and by the medical profession at the request of doctors. It wasn't until the 40s that the Gestapo took it over for political purposes. They discovered that there were two doctors, a Dr. Schwartz in the University of Brandenburg and a Dr. Heinz at the University of Heidelberg, who, because they believed in the concept of eugenics, that, you know, there are some forms of human being that have failed to evolve, based on Darwin's theory of the evolution of species, some of these poor creatures have failed to evolve the way the good guys, the Aryan nation, did, and therefore, as any farm boy from Iowa or Illinois knows, the way you improve the herd is to keep the runts from reproducing. First, it started out with sterilizing the mentally handicapped, the criminals and the gypsies, you know, the malcontent sociopaths of the day. But then they wanted to study under eugenics this brain structure and the bone structures of these less than human type peoples. So they gassed them for medical research progress. Ladies and gentlemen, the gas chambers of Nazi Germany were invented and asked for, run and operated by the medical profession first, later by the Gestapo. At the end of their book, they said, by the way, they really do believe in the slippery slope that we see happening in Netherlands again. At the end of the book, they said, we've learned four lessons. I love them. Here's what they said. Number one, doctors should resist abandoning the individual patient in favor of the group, the community, or the nation. They're saying to doctors, never abandon your individual patient in favor of the group, the nation, or the political party. Second, the wishes of the patient must always be respected. That's why when we teach ethics, we emphasize that autonomy came into being as a result after the Nuremberg trials, the World Health Organization made its Geneva Declaration, and later on a couple more in Helsinki and so on. Patient autonomy is why before any doctor does any invasive technique to you, you must sign an informed consent. They have to explain to you all risk and all benefits, and you call the shot whether you want it or not. The patient wishes must always be respected. Third one, if the patient claims that the treatment offered is inadequate or undesirable, then honor their view and offer an alternative. And they said this should be true even for psychiatrists. If a depressed patient doesn't want electroconvulsive therapy, you say, all right, we will try something else for you, my friend. You don't overrule even a psych patient preferences. And the last one I like the best. They said, after we reviewed what medicine has done when it went astray and did not follow all of the historical principles that have guided ethics, we say this. Never trust a profession that buries its past. That's doctors talking about doctors. Last but not least, I would suggest to you a positive element, and that is what we need to do as Americans preserve in our stampede for healthcare reform. We need to preserve a balance of power between the historical principles that have guided beneficence, non-maleficence, autonomy, and justice, so that we don't have just the debate over distribution of health care push aside or damage the other principles that have guided medicine. I personally believe that a doctor should cure illness. It's not their role to try to cure poverty or political problems. I believe that physicians should not give up their professionalism to insurance companies or computerized programs or the political winds of the day. I personally believe that physicians should not give up their professionalism, their peer review, their principles to either insurance companies or to managed care. When I joined the VA 23 years ago, all 171 hospitals in the VA were run by doctors. Today, none of them are. They're all run by people with business degrees or law degrees. And I also suggest to you that the government should never get between you and your doctor. If you destroy the patient-physician dyad, I believe medicine is in deep trouble. Now, there's some hope, and I want to end on a positive note. There is some hope on the future, and that is that the latest thinking in management is going beyond the old MBO, Management by Objectives, you know, of Drucker. I've got that huge tome that he wrote at home and read some of it. Today, the latest management science is moving beyond MBO principles into principles of leadership. Stephen Covey and others are writing books about principles, that we need to go back to virtues. We need to go back to talking about what is right and wrong in the world of ethics. And I say to you today, on behalf of Mr. Collier and a lot of folks on my ethics committee that I serve on, as chair of our ethics committee, that we see these five trends, that there's political and economic pressures on hospital directors that may be heading us down the wrong railroad track. There are legal intrusions and malpractice costs that are added, that drive up the cost, and that create the gavel of policy that may be driving us down the wrong tracks. There is a push for an early death in an aging society that may be pushing us down the slippery railroad track, and that there may be medicine by math, that the computer printout will predict whether you live or die in an intensive care unit, and that we may be headed towards a few select people who believe in punitive medicine. Contrary to that, I suggest to you that we need to have a balance of the four historical principles that guided medical treatment of patients for thousands of years. The patient, life must be saved by the doctor, prolonged by the doctor, and if he can do nothing else, eliminate pain and suffering, but do no evil to the patient. And that they always observe your autonomy. And then, after having done that, try to work out what is best for the rest of the town, the rest of the community. And I close with a quote from St. Cyprian about 1,000 years. I think he lived 1100 AD. And he once wrote this: custom without truth is the mere seniority of error. I would apply that to healthcare and paraphrase it by saying, reform without principles is the seniority of error. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening. Appreciate your concerns. And be glad to dialogue with you now or at a later date. Thank you very much.